and welcome to the EU and You. I'm Ellen Gunning, and in this series, I hope to explain the EU and its most important institutions. There are four main institutions in the EU: the Court of Justice, the Council of Ministers, the European Parliament, and the European Commission. I'm joined in studio today by Philippe Carr, Press Officer for the European Commission in Dublin, who's going to explain to me how the Commission works. Thanks for coming in, Philippe.
Ellen, thanks for having me.
I really wanted to begin with the most obvious question. What is the Commission and what does it do?
Well, the European Commission has a little bit of a funny role because it's not anything that we have in Irish politics or in the Irish national government system. First of all, the European Commission is a civil service. We are the ones effectively that have to implement a lot of what the other European institutions, the Parliament, which is the democratically elected institution, and the European Council, which is where all the governments meet. We have to implement a lot of what they say. But we also have a very, very important political role as well, in that we have a role to suggest legislation, so that when we find or see problems anyway, we suggest legislation to the European Parliament or to the European Council, or both at the same time, under a process called co-decision, and we are then debate with them and try to find the best possible compromise between those three institutions on what will work. But once that legislation or once that policy is agreed, it's up to us to actually make it work. So we have we're like a civil service, but we're like a political civil service, I suppose.
And if you look at those two areas, you implement, but you also suggest. If you look at implement first, how do you actually implement legislation?
Most of the legislation that we do is implemented through national governments. So, for instance, your European legislation might be decided at the European level. And very often it's important to understand that this legislation is only ever decided with what member states or the governments such as Ireland, in Britain, France want. It's not done just by bureaucrats on their own. It's done with the approval of the national member states and the MEPs that we vote for as well when we go to the European elections. But once we fine-tune that legislation...
Decide, yeah, there is a law to come in.
It's How brought back then. National level then again anyway, so it would be up to the Dáil effectively or the local authorities to implement the different directives and rules that are brought down on European level. So it's very much up to the national governments and the local authorities and local governments as well in Ireland to actually implement that legislation.
So what the Commission does is it almost kind of notifies local government or national government and says this is the legislation that should be implemented, and then keeps an eye to make sure
exactly.
So
it keeps an eye, and if for any one reason one of the laws, for instance, has not been implemented with regards to the general spirit of what was agreed, the European Commission has a right to take the national government to court, the European Court of Justice, and very often that does happen.
Interesting one. So you do have a big stick that you can wield.
Well, there is a big stick, but the whole process with which the European institutions and the European Commission and national governments work is to stop that ever going to the Court of Justice. We will try to find ways, and we will work very, very closely with the national governments to make sure that where we can help them with any problem they might have with implementation of a law.
So really the Court of Justice is the last resort.
It's the last resort when there is a period of time has been gone through. We see that there is maybe not a meeting of minds at a local or national level of how the government is doing things. So we may well refer then. That's the very last option.
And you said that you were like a civil service. Who are you a civil service to?
Well,
who do you answer to?
Well, we answer to the people, but we also answer to, I suppose, effectively directly elected commissioners. So the way the European Commission is actually structured is at the very, very top is there's a president, and his name at the moment is José Manuel Barroso. He's a Portuguese gentleman.
And is he selected now or elected? How does he get his job?
He is selected by the member states, by all the national governments. But then he is approved by the European Parliament. So there's a whole system of checks and balances.
Okay, but essentially all of the member states come together and say, who do we want to be president of the Commission? They agree a name which is then put before the European Parliament for
exactly.
ratification.
It's put forward for ratification, and what effectively the European Parliament does is it says yay or nay to that person.
And obviously, was there also formerly a commissioner? Where did he come from?
He was formerly a prime minister in his own home country. So they tend to be senior statesmen of one form or another. We've had a long history of them, and it's important for them, I suppose, to have a certain degree of political authority as well as individuals, because they're on the world stage. They will be going to G20 summits. They will be working with the different member states at international summits and places like this.
So they need to have been senior politicians first before they become either commissioners
or
the president.
But it usually helps that they, for instance, might well be a senior politician.
Okay, so let's take his job. The governments, the national governments have come together. They've agreed that he should be the president. He's appointed after this ratification process by the European Parliament. He's appointed as the president of the commission. He then has to put in place a whole panel of commissioners who report to him.
He puts together a team, I suppose. And each member state, there's 27 members in the European Union, as we all know. 26 of the member states put forward a candidate. The reason why there isn't a 27th is because Portugal, in this instance,
I was just going to ask,
would just have has the president. In Ireland's case, we forwarded this time around Moira Geoghegan Quinn. She is somebody who's very well respected within the European institutions as being an effective Minister of Justice in her time and senior minister in other areas. She was working for a different European institution beforehand. She's been a little bit outside the national politics, but it was up to the Taoiseach to forward a name of a person that he would want. So what effectively happens is then we have this team of 26 plus one being the president. They again are sent to the European Parliament. And what will effectively happen
just before we get there, does he actually, when they're nominated by each of their governments, so he doesn't have the power to reject somebody that a government has nominated. So if he doesn't feel a commissioner is up to scratch for whatever reason, or he doesn't think they would fit any of the portfolios, he doesn't have the power to go back to the country and say, whoops, not really sure you should have sent me that person, you could send me somebody else. So he effectively gets a 26 commissioners that he must accept and find jobs for.
To a degree, there is that, I suppose, dynamic. But overall, and this is the overall way that Europe works, is he negotiates with the member states, and he might say, listen, I need somebody with a little bit more financial experience. I would like to forward an Irish person, say, for instance, with Charlie McCreevy, into a senior economic portfolio.
The scenes, there's been this sort of chatting, and he said, look, this is the kind of person I'm looking for. And national governments have tic-tacked with him and said, we could possibly offer you...
Exactly. And for instance, with Moira Geoghegan Quinn, she was seen as being an excellent choice because, first of all, she'd been a senior minister. Second of all, she knows the European institutions and she knows them very, very well, having worked within them. And then within it as well, there is a drive as well to ensure that, for instance, this time around, there was more representation amongst female commissioners.
He was very hot on that, actually. I know that was it a public statement that he issued to each of the different governments? But he did say that he was looking for as close to 50-50 representation as he could get. He wanted an equal representation of men and women at the commission.
As far as possible, I suppose the commission has to represent the policy it's sticking out. So that was an important thing. And I'm sure when it went out to the different member states, these are the things that he was looking for. If you can supply me with someone who matches certain criteria that we're looking for, I'll find it easier to make them a commissioner in a certain area. So this time around, Moira Geoghegan Quinn got the innovation portfolio.
And when he actually chooses the portfolios for each of the individuals, then I presume that's a process of negotiation as well, that he actually meets with them and says, look, I have this position in mind for you. Is it something that you would be interested in? Is it something your background is suited to? Before it ever goes to the European Parliament, I presume he has negotiated with them before.
There's a whole process of negotiation. So there will be a certain amount of, well, either we'll give a key portfolio to a big country, for instance, because they will have competences in that area and the commission will find it easier to work within that structure, having come from a big country. Or if it's a very, very strategic portfolio, such as Charlie McCreevy's, they may decide, actually, let's give it to a small country. That way there is no kind of favouritism, I suppose, with regards to the overall system.
And they probably don't bring any baggage that a larger country
they
would
don't.
Bring,
they're
any
seen,
perception or whatever.
They're seen as being more neutral, perhaps. They're seen as being more able to work within the overall system, that they won't actually for their own country's views. One important thing to mention is once a commissioner, the whole process is the team of commissioners either gets accepted on the whole or rejected on the whole.
Yeah, the president then brings them all before the European Parliament.
The European Parliament. The
but
Parliament
they actually,
then.
It's not a straight ratification.
Not
they
at all.
They actually go
no,
through
no,
a
no.
big interview process.
They will be interviewed on a one-on-one basis, and the MEPs will go through them, will ask them all the difficult questions, can have them for 4, 5, 6 hours even in front of the Parliament.
Is this before the full Parliament of 700-odd MEPs?
This is in front of a committee, you know, it's a committee that's representative. I'm not 100% sure now how that committee is selected. That's something you may want to ask one of the institutional people okay. there. But it's...
But they go before a group of people who actually question them about what they're going to do as a commissioner
and
what their policies will be.
And it's a very, very tough interview as well, because obviously there's some very, very key questions that everyone wants to know. They will be holding this commissioner role for 5 years, and under them, they will be guiding EU policy through some very, very important periods. So this time, we had, for instance, we're looking towards a renegotiation of CAP, the Common Agricultural Policy, which obviously affects a lot of countries out there.
And which Ireland will have a huge interest in.
Ireland has a huge interest in. So it was very, very important for the member states to have somebody who, first of all, understood agriculture and also was seen to be fair and balanced. And the commissioner that we chose was chosen, Cholas, he's an East European. He is seen as somebody with an impeccable knowledge of how the EU system works. And a lot of MEPs were very, very happy to have him on board.
And when each of those commissioners now, they go before the Parliament, and the Parliament in this case approved the team that José Manuel Barroso put forward, and he had already approved, they had approved them in the specific positions in which he had nominated them. They now become like heads of their civil service departments, but it's not a department, it's a Directorate General.
That's right.
Tell me how that works.
Well, they effectively are given a Director General. There are 22 of them. 27 of them, excuse me, including Barroso's.
You're beginning to get me worried there with my mental maths, yeah.
I'm losing it. And for instance, they go from the internal market to fisheries and maritime policy to transport.
So they all have a specific responsibility.
They all have a specific responsibility.
Like an Irish department. You know the way in Ireland, if there's a new election and you have a new government comes in, so the department is civil service, if you like, the structure, the people who administer what this commissioner would want done
sure.
remain the same, more or less. But if you've had a change of government, you have a change of emphasis and you have a whole new policy put in place. Does the same thing happen within the European Commission, or is there like a grand vision for 20 years and the next new team that comes in picks up that grand vision and builds on it? Or is it new every time there's a new commission?
There are changes of emphasis, for instance, and the second Barroso commission, he was commissioner for the last previous 5 years as well. They do forward new ideas, one of them being, for instance, the change from what we call the Lisbon Strategy. That's nothing to do with the Lisbon Treaty, by the way. We can stay away, well, way away from that.
Okay.
But there was a change of emphasis in policy from what they call the Lisbon Strategy, which is absolutely nothing to do with the Lisbon Treaty, by the way. And that is the European Union's policy towards developing a new industrial base, towards a new economy, emphasis on developing the smart economy, and also developing a lot of structural change as well. So things like the National Development Plan in Ireland as well. It was seen to need a little bit of an upgrade. It had originally been cast in the early part of the last decade. What the Commission came up with as an idea was called Europe 2020. which has new goals, which is not just simply to do with economics and development of a smart economy, but is also to do with things like poverty reduction, to do with ways of trying to find unemployment during the during and after the crisis for younger people and for slightly older people as well, who will be particularly isolated because of the recession. It's to find new solutions to the problems. You can't just simply keep on going ahead, planning ahead with the same strategy.
That's a very fair point. That the Lisbon strategy probably did take that sort of 20-year vision. But the new Europe 2020 looked at it and said, well, really, we need to take it down off the shelf, dust it off a little bit, take account of the fact that there is this economic recession and we need to maybe retarget or refocus some of our policies.
Nearly all the countries in Europe have suffered from this recession, and for any institution to just go blindly by and say, oh, let's continue as business as normal, well, it's just not realistic.
And can I just ask you about the number of commissioners? Now, I may be entirely wrong, but I thought during the last referendum, one of the big issues for Ireland was the fact that we were going to lose a commissioner, that the number of commissioners was going to reduce, and that actually what happened as a result of the last treaty renegotiation or whatever was that each country retains its commissioner. I know that each commissioner doesn't represent its own national country, but it's very important for countries to have a commissioner. And I presume the implication is that as Europe gets bigger and bigger and bigger, we're going to have more and more and more departments, which presumably are going to specialise in smaller areas.
We may well see that. We saw during the last referendum that people in Ireland, but also there was some other people in the rest of Europe, felt that having somebody from their own nationality at the highest table in the Commission was very, very important. The idea that had been enshrined in the first Lisbon Treaty before Ireland got solemn declarations, promises, was that we would have less commissioners than member states. So people were saying, for instance, that the whole idea was, yes, you will have smaller DGs, you will have smaller departments.
And the commissioners would rotate. It wasn't that the country would never have a commissioner again.
No, it was just that you might have one every so many years. Every 10 years.
Let me ask you one final very fast question. If the EU has moved towards centralising a foreign affairs role, albeit only those areas of foreign affairs that they can agree, do you think there'll be a centralised environment minister, a centralised finance minister? Is that the way it's going in the next, I don't know, 10, 20 years?
Foreign policy has always been one of the very, very special areas that member states have always been very reluctant to give too much power to the Commission, because they see it as being vital to their national interests. In the environment, there is a general acceptance that in certain key areas like climate change, we just have to get it together. And we do that through the Commission. And the Commission plays in a very, very important role that way to do it.
So you don't think the role of these high commissioners will increase? You think it'll probably stay with...
I think there's a general philosophy in the European Union called subsidiarity, which means that the best decisions are taken at the best level, whether they be local in the community or wherever it's going to be, whether it be within the local authority and it being at the national level, or whether it be at the EU level. And for instance, a lot of environmental decisions are best taken at the environmental level, and at the national level, excuse me. And there's not that much shift anyway to decentralise that too much. There's always the view is, will Europe centralise more and more? How will it go forward? There's no answer to that, you know, overall. There's some people who have a view that Europe should be this big centralised entity. But there's a lot of people, and I say a lot, lot more people, who think that the best decisions are made at a national level, and the EU is very welcome in some areas, but national level, let's just keep national governments looking after it.
On that note, we close. Philippe Carr, Press Officer with the European Commission in Dublin, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks very much.
Having spoken with Philippe, I decided to catch up with Francis Jacobs, head of the European Parliament Office here in Ireland, and ask him to put the roles of the Parliament and the Commission into perspective for me. Thanks for joining me, Francis.
Thank you very much, Ellen.
Now, can I ask you the first really crucial question? It seems to me we've listened to interviews about the European Parliament, we've listened to interviews about the Commission. I wanted to put you on the spot, really, and ask you, it looks like there's been a power shift over the years, and that the Commission used to have much more power, but that power has now shifted to the European Parliament. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it's a very fair assessment. And essentially, even since I've been working in the Parliament has shifted from being a bystander to many of the key decisions in which it's been trying to influence the decision, but hasn't been a direct participant, to sitting around the table and actually helping to take the decisions. It's been a huge change over the years. Perhaps it might be helpful just to say what the situation used to be like.
Please.
For a long time, if you take the most important thing probably the European Union does, which is to adopt European Union laws, in those days, the Commission would put forward the proposal, acting as a civil service, but doing the first draft, would send it to the European Parliament. The European Parliament would be just consulted, really. It would give its opinion. It didn't have any binding say in the process. And then it left the Parliament and went over to the Commission and the Member States, the Irish government and the other Member States, to reach a decision. And when...
So Parliament was really just consulted, but they didn't have to pay any attention to it?
Exactly.
Is that right?
In fact, the only really important thing for the other institutions was to make sure that Parliament had given its opinion and a box had been ticked. Now, of course, if the Parliament gave some very good criticisms of the proposal, the other institutions might listen to it, but they had no formal right to listen to the Parliament. And it was extremely frustrating for the members of the European Parliament, even after the first direct elections in 1979, because what used to happen is that the discussions which were taking place between the Commission, who'd put forward the proposal, and the Member States, the Parliament wasn't present at those discussions, and neither did the Member States describe what was happening to the Parliament. Everything was filtered through the Commission officials. They would come to the European Parliament committees and say what was going on, which it might have been an accurate description, or it might have been a rather partial description of what was going on. The European Parliament had no direct means of knowing. That has completely changed.
I presume that arose because originally the European Parliament was made up of people who were nominated by their governments, and they were seen very much as a consultative body.
Yeah,
but once you begin to elect parliamentarians to a parliament, you expect them to be consulted, but it has to become much more than a box ticking. You've got to presume that the person that I sent to Parliament is listened to seriously, not just has been consulted. So how did it change?
It changed not immediately after direct elections, because before direct elections, when the Parliament consisted of nominated parliamentarians from all the national parliaments, so there were members of the Oireachtas, but they were only in the European Parliament for a certain period every year. They weren't full-time members of the European Parliament either. After direct elections, the newly elected Parliament said, look, we've got exactly as you've hinted, Ellen. You know, we've got greater legitimacy. We should have more powers. But in fact, it's been a very, very long process. And it's been a series of changes over the last 30 years, which have led to the present situation, culminating in the Lisbon Treaty, which has given the European Parliament far more powers and completed much of that process.
Was it the Lisbon Treaty that actually, sorry for cross-talking you, was it the Lisbon Treaty that brought in this co-decision?
No, the co-decision procedure was actually brought in, which sounds like jargon. What it means in practice is for the first time, the European Parliament could reject proposals for European laws coming from the Commission. And if there was disagreement between the European Parliament and the Member States, the Irish government and the other governments, they would sit around a table and hammer out a compromise. That was introduced for the first time in the Maastricht Treaty in the early 1990s. But it didn't apply to all European Union laws. For instance, really major areas of importance for Ireland, like agriculture and fisheries, were not covered by that. And the old consultative role still
remained.
Applied. So you had, on the one hand, in certain areas like environment policy, you had the European Parliament able to amend and reject laws. While in other areas like agriculture, it gave its opinion and said it liked or disliked the proposals, but didn't have a binding say. It was still in its old consultative mode. And that was something which was very hard for people like me to explain as well. Why is the European Parliament powerful in some areas where the European Union has power and weak in others?
And has that changed since, or is it the same still?
No, since the Lisbon Treaty, Now, the power to codecide, in other words, the power for the European Parliament to amend and reject European Union laws, now applies to almost all legislation. I forget the exact figure, but you're talking about 95%. Almost all the significant areas of legislation, including agriculture, is now covered by this co-decision power. The other thing which has changed enormously is on the budget, because the European Parliament, the first area where it really got big powers were in the annual budget, but it only had the last say on the budget, again, in certain areas and not in others. Again, the agricultural budget, the European Parliament had less power. This anomaly is gone, and now the European Parliament has the same really great power over the annual budget, right across the budgetary, the whole area of the European Union budget. And that's a huge change.
It sounds almost as if, and I don't mean to be flippant about this, but it sounds as if the European Parliament is developing in a way that reflects the fact that people actually directly elect it and want to have a say in how Europe is run, and that the Commission almost is becoming what people would expect it to be, which is more of a civil service serving the needs of the member states in whatever way, but with much less influence on their side and much more of an administrative role. But I don't know if that's a fair conclusion.
I mean, in theory, they've always been a European civil service. But of course, with the commissioners very often having political backgrounds, and because of the really important role the commission had in helping to broker deals on European Union legislation, on the budget, and so on, in practice, they were a very powerful civil service indeed. Now, with the European Parliament brought in fully into the equation, you now have the Parliament, the directly elected Parliament, the member states and the Commission all sitting around the table. But instead of being much more powerful than the European Parliament, the Commission is now in an intrinsically weaker position. They put forward the proposal so they can help to shape the initial proposal. But then if the European Parliament and the Council don't like what the Commission has done, they can cut a deal against the wishes of the Commission. That doesn't mean that the Commission has become powerless, because the Commission, if it plays its cards intelligently, can still be an important player. But on every issue, it has to show that it's got a real role to play. And if it plays its cards badly, it's out of the game. That's a huge difference. The Parliament no longer has to ask the Commission what's happening in the negotiations of the member states, because it deals directly with them. It's got its own direct sources of information.
So, I like that shift, I must say. I think it's one that we're going to have to watch for the future. For now, Francis Jacobs, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much, Ellen.
You've been listening to 103.2 Dublin City FM. This series was presented and produced by Ellen Gunning. Sound engineering was by David O'Grady. The series was made with the assistance of the Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe Initiative.